involvement, you know, the different ways in which you find yourself involved with issues around the HIV crisis?
I guess as an advocate on many levels, because I am so diversified. Because I have a Latina cultural background, because I am a lesbian, being a mother, being a grandmother, I would say an advocate on a whole lot of different levels. That's how I would define myself. That's a label I would put on myself. I've done stuff like, films that was an absolutely positive, and I'm on the board of directors of GMHC, and I'm also on the mayor's HIV planning council and on the advisory council. I could speak on issues of prison, women in prison, on substance abuse. There's so many different facets to who I am, that I have to go back to, I couldn't describe myself. One label, advocate, would kind of like cover it. And I have the willingness to share about all these parts of who I am. And I've come to a place to realize that it's not so much for the person who asks me to do it as it is as much for my own personal growth. This gives me an opportunity with a guy to take a closer look at who I am every time that I do this. So I advocate for myself on a real personal level. And then whoever my stuff affects. And I know it affects people, I just never really know who.
What was your life like before AIDS became an issue?
My life? I abused drugs most of my life. I started using drugs very early when I was I started with alcohol, and the disease of addiction is a progressive disease, and I was about 6 when I started, and cigarettes and cigars and marijuana and acid and cocaine and heroin and pills and all kinds of stuff. If it was something that allowed me not to deal with who I was, if it was something that allowed me not to feel my feelings, I was with it. And it was about basically, I guess, not feeling my feelings. And sometimes when drugs didn't work, well, sex did, I was consumed by a lot of negativity. And all the negative things that I gravitated to allowed me not to feel, allowed me not to know who I was. Actually, it kept me suppressed most of my life. I think it has a lot to do also with messages that I received growing up. I grew up in Williamsburg in Brooklyn, on the South Side, and it was a pretty mixed neighborhood, and Jewish and white people, Irish people, and Puerto Ricans and Black people, and I remember, like in school, the messages that I got a lot was that Puerto Ricans were liars and they were thieves and they went to prison and they were stupid. And, you know, I say I've been an addict all my life because I gravitated to that information. I mean, you know, Puerto Ricans are also very very romantic and beautiful and intelligent, but for some reason or other, I was never able to grasp that piece. And I look at the messages that I got around being a woman, and they were basically the same, you know? You know, a woman, you have children, and you stay home, and you get a man, and he takes care of you, and he takes care of the house, and the man usually has women outside of the relationship, and I kind of didn't like that. But that was another message that I got. And then I sat down and watched TV at home, and I seen Donna Reed, you know, and Father Knows Best. And that was totally different from the messages that I was getting in my reality. Totally different. And again, I felt that that could never be for me. The Donna Reeds, the Father Knows Best, the Cleaver family, you know, Leave It to Beaver, and that would never be my reality. I knew there was something wrong with the picture. And basically, I think what I got real early on, you know, in school and at home and from the media, from the workplace, you know, the environment that I grew up in. I lived in a neighborhood where there was a lot of poor families, low-income family, and a lot of people were on public assistance, and there was a lot of drug addiction even at that time. I was born in the 50s. I was born in 52. But I remember one of the buildings that we lived in, there was a lot of drug abuse in that building. You know, the addicts would go up to the roof to shoot up and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes when we were going to school in the morning, you had to walk over people that, you know, had passed out on the stairwell. And they were black or Puerto Rican, you know. And you're seeing them on the corners. And actually, you know, this kind of belief that, you know, well, what's it all worth? You know, is it worth it? There was a sense of worthlessness that I picked up and that I gravitated to and that I nurtured, you know, like real early on. And I know it came from a lot of different sources. And this kind of stuff also, I nurtured a lot of low self-esteem. And that's how my life went. And it was, drugs allowed me not to feel all that. Drugs allowed me not to think about that. That I incorporated in who I was. You know, when I look at, well, what did I hear when I was growing up about lesbians? And about gay people? You know, that they were freaks. You know, that they were worthless. But they weren't to be trusted. That it was sick. That they were crazy. That they weren't normal. This is like, I gravitated to all those negative messages that I always, you know, a lot of name calling. You know, I remember early in school and hearing some boys calling the other one faggot, you know, faggot, you're queer, you know. I really didn't understand what it was, but it meant different. It meant different and it meant unacceptable. And Spanish, when you say a queer, un pato, un maricón, it sounds so degrading, And so for me, that was another faucet that was really, really unacceptable, So it was like the person that I was really unacceptable. I didn't want to talk Spanish when I was in school because I didn't want people to know that I was Puerto Rican. It's like really funny, things that you formulate in your head and how you formulate, how I formulate my belief system. I didn't want people to know that I was Puerto Rican. So I remember my best friend, who still today is, I don't see very much of her, but when I see her, it's like we've never stopped seeing each other. She was Jewish, and I was like real comfortable with Sarah. I was like, and I'm still real comfortable with Sarah. I didn't really have to talk Spanish when I was with her, And it's still a part of who I am. A lot of my friends are white, And I know that some of that stuff comes from, being a kid and not wanting to be what I was. I definitely didn't want to be what I was. And drugs facilitated that for me. Drugs allowed me to not deal with reality, not feel, and not be a part of life. I look at that as it being a reality now, but then it was like real comfortable, and I created my comfortability around drugs and lost my family as a direct result of that, because I stole from them and I lost my home and I became a bum in the street. I was like your average shopping bag lady without a shopping bag, and I lived in the shelter system for a lot of years. And it was between the shelter system and the jails and the institutions. Rehabs and detoxes and a whole range of institutions that I went to. Reaching the point of, like all you want is like death. I think I wanted death like real early on because I was so uncomfortable with who I was, the uncomfortability. And I think that maybe that's where drugs took me to early on when I first started using drugs. It was fun. Maybe the first 9 years of my using alcohol and drugs, it was fun. But then when I crossed what some people call the invisible line where I just had to use, I couldn't function without using. I couldn't function if I didn't use a drug or a drink. I couldn't get in the shower, and I did whatever I had to do to get my drugs. It became a part of who I was. And it's a funny thing, but I started to create a family wherever I went, And the family that I was like most comfortable with was when I went to jail, and I was in a housing area. I come from a family of six girls. We're six girls, and we were all women. So it was almost like creating my other five sisters being there, and the guards were my parents, and these things I've learned, through therapy and being in recovery. But it's funny when I think about it. I went to jail to get my family when it was so simple. I had a family at home that if I stopped using drugs, I would have. But I would go, it was the same scenario when I lived in a woman's shelter. When I was in a woman's shelter, I was recreating my family all over again. There was a curfew. They locked the doors in jail. They lock you in at a certain time and that's it. They provide for you. Just like my parents provided for me, And the last 5 years of my active addiction, I spent most of that time in jail. And it was like real short bits. But I wouldn't be out in the street any more than 2 months at a time. Almost like that need for family, you know? And the only place that I could really, really get that was, at that time, I believed it was in jail, was in the shelter system. And I guess when things started to get a bit tough, I kept on doing geographics. My geographics were between a shelter system and a jail. They were all within the institution. You know, and I've learned this stuff, you know, just being in recovery and, you know, going to therapy and doing group therapy and all that kind of stuff. But the patterns that I created and how these patterns started real, real early on, you know, and that lack of trust that was also was something that I learned very early on, you know. Like I said, and growing up in the family that I grew up in, my father was a womanizer, and my mother was barefoot and pregnant, a typical Puerto Rican. And it was, there was a lot of trust issues there. I didn't like the situation at home. I didn't like the fighting. I guess I picked up a lot of that non-trusting stuff. My father coming home and making accusations, based on how he was living his life. And my mother being at home when he would come in 3 days later making accusations, and that no trust. There was in my home, there was no trust, you know, between my parents. So all that stuff I incorporated in my life, and the belief that this is the way it's supposed to be.
When in all of this did you begin to call yourself a lesbian?
I began to call myself a lesbian when I was about 20 years old, and I went to work at this place, and I met these two women who didn't use any drugs, and they were both lesbians, and they liked me, and they hooked into me, and I hooked into them because they would buy me drugs. And they supported my habit, and I hooked into that, and I started hanging out with them more and more, and I took my son and I told his father to take him. I left my apartment and I went to live with these two women, and throughout these 2 years I moved away from my family and didn't see my son for about a 2 year period. And throughout these 2 years, I was busy creating a new identity for myself. I didn't know that that's what I was doing, but that's what I was doing. When I came back, I no longer wore a skirt, I no longer wore makeup, I no longer... My idea of what a lesbian was real distorted. As distorted as the stuff that I heard growing up. These two women that I lived with wore skirts and wore nylons and wore makeup and all this stuff. But for me, a lesbian had to wear jockey shorts and BVDs and all this other stuff. And I know that that's clearly from where I came from as a child, because when I would hear a conversation, or I remember my sister getting punished and getting hit because there was this lesbian that lived across the hall from us. And my sister would talk with her, and my mother didn't like that at all. And my sister got punished for that, you know. So it was definitely a bad thing. It was so bad that I could not keep my son. I could not be a lesbian and keep my son. A decision that I made, no one told me that these are the rules that I created in my head. I created the rule that, you know what, a lesbian's not supposed to have children. So I told his father, you know, come and pick up Lewis because where I'm at right now, I can't deal with him. And I got up and I left my apartment and I went to live with these two women. And I just like got up and left the apartment. I mean, furniture. I took my clothes. That was it. And that's why I call it getting a whole new identity. And when I came back home, kind of like a different person. I remember my mother would tell me stuff like, you're not really like that, you know, and me being the rebellious person and child that I grew up, that gave me even more incentive to prove to her that this is how I was. And whatever women I was involved with, I always brought home. And my mother, whenever she had a chance, would remind me that I was not really like that, or whatever that was. She didn't give it any name. You're just not like that. It was real confusing. I just didn't know it was confusing. I mean, when I look back on it, I was like real confused about who I was, and where did I fit? What was my role? You know, what was my role? And it's still like that sometimes. And as a result of it being like that, I've had relapses with drugs again. You know, I've had more than my share of relapses because I usually reach a point, or I have reached points where I am so darn uncomfortable with who I am, and I see that I have a lot of work to do, that scary work. It's like I'm so scared to find out who I am. Because I guess so early on, I learned that became an escape for me, you know, till I became chemically dependent. I have found myself in recovery trying to find the same security that I found in substances before. Only difference is there is no security there today. You know, because of the work that I've done, I've reached a certain point where there is no security in drugs. There is no that safe place that I used to find 25 or 30 years ago. It's not there, you know, only to realize that I have to put one foot in front of the other and keep on stepping. And that is the only way to get relief. And sometimes it doesn't feel like that. However, when I look at it in retrospect, I see the relief, and I'm able to experience relief for moments. But I learned how to deal with everything, or how not to deal with everything, through chemical dependency, you know. And it didn't, early on, it didn't matter, you know, what chemical it was.
When were you diagnosed?
I was diagnosed in 88.
And how did that happen?
I was in a therapeutic community at that time. And there were a lot of people there that were positive. And I like didn't. I knew that I had, well, talk about risk, God. You know, I just knew that I had to be positive. And I was scared to find out. Because I don't know, like somewhere in my head, it was like, you test positive and then you die tomorrow. You know. And some people died while I was in this therapeutic community, and some people were living with it, and some people used to whine and pune and cry about it. And And it was like, well, you know, if so long as you don't test, you don't have to deal, you know. And then I started thinking, well, you know what? Maybe if I find out that I am positive, that will give me an initiative to never again use drugs. I was getting ready to start working and all this other stuff, and it's like, well, maybe, you know, this, maybe getting a positive status will be like a guarantee that I won't use again. And then there was this, the other part of me that wants to die, you know, there's that other part of me. Well, maybe if I do get tested, well, then I will die tomorrow, and I won't have to deal with getting a job and growing up and going to live on my own. And I had all these different things going on in my head. And then there was the other piece of wanting to belong. And thinking that maybe this would be a way for me to fit. You know. And I remember having a counselor who was very much against my going to test. And she told me, you're trying real hard to fit. And an HIV status is not the answer. And it was like, I wasn't with that, you know, I didn't want to hear that. And I went ahead and I tested, and when I tested, you know, I had my pre and my post. And the pre, the person who did it was a gay man who I respect a lot today. And he was, he's an executive position at this program that I was in. And he kind of like took me under his wing, and he did, you know, the pre-testing. And we talked, and then he also gave me my results. And it was, it was like when he was telling me that I was positive, it was like he was talking to somebody else. He wasn't talking to me. I sat there like, who the fuck is he talking to? And it's me and him in this little room. And I'm in a, I'm like in disbelief. As much as I knew I was positive, that's how much I wished I wasn't, you know? I think I tested and it was like, just maybe, this shit didn't get me. But I wasn't like in touch with that when I tested. When I look at it now, I think that's because I was like I really couldn't hear. I really couldn't hear what he was saying other than the fact that I was positive. And there was a lot of fear that I couldn't get in touch with. I was just like numb. I just like numbed out. And I remember I used to do volunteer work at for NDRI at this program that I was in, and I go to another site on Thursdays. And what this site, what this in this volunteer work that I was doing, what they did was they tested addicts and they gave them like $10 for doing a questionnaire, an interview. And then they would test. Most of them didn't come back for their results. They just wanted like the $10, you know, to go do whatever they needed to do. And I, the van came to pick me up and it was taking me back to the facility. And I remember thinking on the van, I am not going to tell anybody that I'm positive. I'm not going to tell nobody. Because then they're going to want me to talk about it. Then I'm going to have to sit in groups, and they are going to want me to talk about this. And I'll be damned if I'm going to sit in any group and cry and whine and fume about being positive. I don't recall any thoughts about being sick or anything like that. I did think briefly that I was going to die. And I have this knack about me that I'm able to just take stuff and file it. You know, it comes up and I just like file it, and I think it goes into the dead file, you know? There was such a rainbow of emotions that all I could relate to was numbness. And I got to the facility and when I got in, my counselor was there, and the executive director of the woman's component was there, and I went directly to them and I told them. And I cried a little bit, and they reached out to me, and I immediately got involved. 2 weeks later, I was in a women's group. And I grew a lot in that women's group. And I started working, and I just went on with my life. I filed it. I tested positive, and I knew that there were things that I had to do, and I just went on doing them, and I did what they told me I had to do. And, I started going, I got involved with, there was a study going on, and if you partook in the study, they did your blood work every 3 months. And they gave me my test results, and that's how I first, it was an anonymous study, and it was a way for me to have my blood work done. And I didn't know very much about insurance, and I didn't really want to disclose to anyone. I was really afraid. One of the things that I got involved with that study was because I was always like afraid that they're gonna take all the people that had AIDS and put them on an island and exile them. Early on, I was like really terrified of that. Okay, well I didn't die already. Okay, so one day if they really know my name, they're gonna come and get me, and they're going to put me on this island. And this is like thoughts in my head and the fear. And then, I started sharing in this group, and the group leader really took me under her wing. I have been real lucky with this. I have been extremely lucky, and I can't say it feels like lucky, and I use that word for I guess lack of a better word. But I think it's been a result of my continuing to put one foot in front of the other. I think that's the bottom line. 2 weeks later, I was in the support group. I went to the support group every Thursday. The support group was run by a registered nurse. And the 3 weeks out of the month, we would, it was just a support group, and we talked about whatever was going on with us. And once a month, it would be medical information, and this woman would come in and talk to us about safer sex and tell us about the different treatments and talk to us about the women's groups that we can go to, different medications and vitamins and early on I learned that I needed to take acidophilus every day. I needed to take garlic pills every day. My T-cell count was really high, and there was really nothing that I needed to do other than take care of myself and not use drugs. So I took my vitamin C. I took my acidophilus. I tried lithium for a while. It really wasn't working for my... It didn't agree with me real well, so I stopped that. The things that did agree with me, I continued to take, and I still take, and then I had a loss. 8 months after my knowing my status, I lost the first person really close to me. This person got sick, got his diagnosis, and 3 weeks later he was dead. And that was real painful. It was real painful to see his process. It was real painful to see the family process. It was real painful to see the fear and the ignorance and transference was like just happening, and I didn't know it. I wasn't aware that everything that was happening around me, I was personalizing. And along with that, with the personalizing, there was a surmountable amount of fear with that. Real big fear that my family was going to leave me, all of my family members knew my status. Because I did, I told my family immediately. I told my son, I told my mother, I told my sisters. My father doesn't know. I told, there were some family members who don't know. And don't know because I told them. I'm sure my entire family knows. But that I have not told what the people that are close to me, you know, and the people that I feel need to know my status know it. Today I'm out, today I don't hide it, you know. I really don't care who knows. No one can hurt me any more than I can hurt me. Nobody has the power to hurt me that I have, you know, and my lifestyle proves that, you know. So it doesn't like really matter to me who knows. But it was a process, you know. Going through the fear of what's going to happen when I tell my mother. You know, is my mother not going to love me anymore? Is my sister not going to want me in her house? You know, and I had to deal with that kind of stuff because I was in a therapeutic community, and I remember telling my older sister, she's like 2 years older than me, and I said, you know, and I told her that I tested, and she never came to visit me, and the reason why she wouldn't come to visit me at the therapeutic community was because she knew there were other people there that had AIDS, and she said she didn't want to take those germs home with her to her children. And that was like, that made me like really, really angry. But then there was another part of me that understood that, and that it was okay, because I didn't have that much information. And I did have information, but I don't trust because I have trust issues, you know. I don't really trust what a doctor, still I don't really trust what a doctor tells me, because I think I know more about me than a doctor knows about me. You know, they're doing a lot of research has not been done. So I don't really like trust too tough. You know, I make my own decisions. Yes, I consult with my doctor, and I consult with other people that live with this virus. For me, those are the experts. I have a hard time dealing with what a doctor thinks I should do next. So like when my sister came out with that, I don't want to take this to my family. It hurt because it was a part of me that said, this disease could only be transmitted, you know, through blood or semen. You can't carry this on your clothes. You can't carry this. But then there was a part of me that said, they don't really know if you can carry this home. So it was like the push, you know, the tug of war going on inside of me. So like sometimes it was okay for her to take that stance, but sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it wasn't. Sometimes it felt lonely. Sometimes it felt scary, you know, that I had this germ in my body, that you could look at me as a germ and not want to be next to me or close to me. And that was like, that lasted for a very long time. Because going into the second year of knowing my status, my younger sister had a little boy, and I didn't want to touch him. Although I knew there was only three ways that I can pass this virus on to somebody else, there's a thing in my mind that, well, maybe if I breathe on him, this baby doesn't have a real immune system. If I breathe on him, or if I cough on him, I might infect him, and he will die. And the first about 2 months of little Michael's life, I wouldn't touch him. I'd watch him from a distance. And it was real painful because I was real close. I'm real close to my younger sister. And although she was the only one that went to visit me at the therapeutic community with all those people that had the virus, and she was pregnant. And she didn't have this fear that she was going to die if she went into this place and breathed the same air. So there's a special kind of bonding with this sister of mine. And one day she actually took the baby and put him on my lap, and it was like, I just like take him back. Take him back. And I told her, you're crazy. And she says, you can't hurt him. And that kind of that helped a lot, you know. I realized that the rejection really that people, a lot of the rejection that people give you is a rejection that you give yourself. That's what I've kind of realized. I have a lot of people in my life that talk about rejection and being treated different. And I haven't experienced that. I know what I went through with my sister because of her lack of information. But once she got with it and learned, well, I changed. And it's like that with my entire family. My aunts, no, not because I told them, I think because my cousins told them. And I haven't experienced any rejection from my family. I haven't experienced any rejection, although I haven't been hospitalized because of my status, but I haven't gone to a hospital or to a doctor or to a dentist where I've stated my status and I state it wherever I go, and I've been rejected. I think rejection is kind of like a state of mind in a lot of instances. You know, if that's what you put out there, that's what you get back. So I can't really like relate to rejection like some people do with this virus. I mean, I can relate to rejection, but with this virus, I haven't experienced it in the job place. But then I'm not real willing to work for private sector. I'm not, because I know there's a lot of ignorance there. And no, I'm not willing to go into an agency and be anybody's pawn like that. So I just I wouldn't go and work in private sector with my status, because I've worked real hard to be able to say I'm HIV positive. To have to go someplace and work and not be able to say that and cheat myself out of that freedom. Because they will fire you. You know, some places will fire you in private sector because of your status, or won't want to insure you. You know, that goes on. Being active in the community and doing volunteer work and connecting with people with this virus has puts me in a real safe place. I know where to go. I know how to access whatever I need. And I know a lot of people in different places. So there's a lot of benefits in just getting active and in giving. Because when you give, you just automatically get back. And you get back a lot more than what you give.
When you discovered that you were positive, did you, as part of the process of coming to terms with that yourself, try and tell yourself a story about the moment at which you became infected?
Yeah.
Did you think about that? Do you think, well, it was this, it was, sure, it was because I did this at this time in this way?
What I told myself is that I believe I've been infected since about 82. If initial infection really happens the way they say that it happens, that it's a flu-like thing, with fevers and chills and a flu that you can't shake off. Well, I had that in 82. And I was in jail at the time. I don't recall getting sick after that. I think I came down one time after that with hepatitis. But to get sick without really knowing what was happening with me, to get treated with antibiotics and it take about 2 months for whatever was happening to clear up, I'm not a sickly kind of person. And when I think about that, it's like, you know, there's a very good possibility that I've been infected since. How I became infected, I don't have the foggiest idea if it was sexually or if it was through IV abuse. I don't know. Like I said, when I was out there and I was drugging, I was out there. You know, I was homeless. If I needed a set of works and didn't have the money to get a set of works, and I found a set on the gutter, I picked them up, rinsed them out, and used them. If I had to go into a shooting gallery, at that time there would be a cup like this, and there would be a bunch of syringes in there, and you'd just take one from there. And if I was really sick, it wasn't about rinsing them out. It was about, I just took them out, I fixed whatever I needed to fix in a cooker, and I didn't know if anybody had threw blood in the cooker or not. I never practiced safer sex. So I really don't know. I don't have the foggiest idea how this happened. I know it wasn't a blood transfusion. I never had a blood transfusion. So that kind of like takes care of that, you know. But I know that
you have known about AIDS and HIV before you were diagnosed.
Yeah.
Had you sort of, when you had heard about AIDS, had you decided that, you know, there was something you needed to do to change
not.
The way?
Yeah.
Because you just thought, oh, I'm not going to get sick, or like.
No, that's the kind of stuff you put in the dead file. I remember being with this woman, and we were sharing this piece of candy, and she said, "Are you sure you don't have AIDS?" And I didn't know what the hell she was talking about. And she knew I had my drug history. She wasn't a drug user, but she knew that I had my history. And I said, I said, "What is AIDS?" And she told me, something about it being an immune deficiency, and I really didn't care. You know, whatever it was she was talking about, I didn't have it. You know, and I didn't know what AIDS was. And I just like let it go, and that was like in 82, 83. I had just done like 3 years in the federal penitentiary, and I was in a halfway house, and I remember because we were like, I remember where we were on 2nd Avenue and 7th Street, and we were crossing the street over to the bakery. There's a bakery right there on the corner, and that's just like my attitude. And then like in 85 I was in Rackers Island. And there was this woman there who people were saying had AIDS. I remember that then I seen AIDS for the first time. And I believe that she had dementia. She had some stuff happening. And she was still in the same housing area that I was in, and she'd spend all this time, like, in standing in front of the mirror, like, staring at herself. She was a black woman who had, like, this. I had done time with her at other times. And she was a small little black lesbian, and her skin was no longer brown. Her skin had like this grayish, ashy color to it. And I would walk like around her like real scared, because whatever she had was gonna jump on me. It was kind of like the feeling. And I remember, you know, there was like all these toilet stalls reminded me of a stable, really. And in front of it was the showers, maybe about eight toilet stalls and eight showers across the room, and they faced each other. And I used to watch what shower she used, because I wasn't going into the shower that she used. And I watched what toilet bowl she used, because I wasn't going to sit on it. And I wouldn't walk around her bed. I'd walk to the other side of our housing area so that I wouldn't. And I hated when she was standing in front of that mirror and I needed to go to the bathroom because I had to pass by her. And I was like really terrified of this virus. Scared. Not scared of her, but scared. Well, yeah, scared of her. Scared of this virus, scared that whatever she had, I was going to get. And I really didn't have any clear understanding. There was no education going on in the prison system at all at that time. When you got really sick, they isolated you. That's what they did with you. Meanwhile, they just left you in the housing area. And I continued to go in and out of, you know, the prison system. And I continued to see people come in, like, with AIDS. You know, and people, she has AIDS, stay away from her, you know, I'm drinking from a cup, don't sit on my bed, you know, that kind of shit. But still, I wasn't bringing it home to me. I didn't bring it home to me the use of drugs keeps you in denial, you know, and toward the end of my active addiction, I used to go into jail and I would get on the methadone program. If you were doing under a year, they'd keep you on methadone if that's what you wanted. You know, 40 milligrams a day. And it was something to negotiate with, that if you didn't have any money, so you can pick up your methadone and spit it back in a bottle and sell it to somebody else for cigarettes or cookies or... So usually when I would roll into jail, I'd get on the KEEP program, they called it. I don't know if they still call it the same thing, but I would get on the KEEP program and and I'd get methadone so that I can trade it for cigarettes. You know, and I'd swallow a little bit of it so that I wouldn't get sick from withdrawal. For the first couple of days, and then after that, you know, in the beginning you get it for 2 weeks, and for a 14-day detox, they call it. And if you were doing something like 6 months and you were going to go back out to the street, you could make a decision, look, put me on the program, because when I go back out to the street, I'm going to stay on the methadone program. And they would do that. So usually that's what I was doing to at the end. In the beginning, I would just take my detox and trade it for cigarettes or whatever. And I take my stay in jail as a time to recoup. Why I call it get my ribs out of hock. And I just like take it easy till I hit back on the streets. I knew when I went out, I was going to use again. And my attitude was, well, when I go out, I'll really be able to get plastered because my system will be clean. But toward the end, it was no longer like that. It was like I would get whatever I could get my hands on. And, you know, you'd hear on the methadone line, you know, don't get a spit back from that one because she got AIDS, don't, you know. You know, the denial around. I mean, nobody really had any information, and nobody really was really like, Rikers Island is like a revolving door. You know, the same people just keep on coming you know, through the door till you get caught out there and they send you out to Bedford Hills, or you die, you know. But a lot of people continue to come back through the system. And some people would say, ah, she doesn't have AIDS, you know. You didn't even call it HIV then, you know, HIV and disease. It was just called AIDS, you know, and, you know, oh, you can get it from her. She doesn't have any AIDS. And people are just like talking shit, and the trade would continue, you know, and that's what it was like for me being in prison with this and living with people that had this virus. Then when I came out, the beginning of '88, and I decided to test and that kind of stuff. I don't know when you know, I went through that thing of watching people who had this virus and becoming informed. Now at the therapeutic community, there were people coming up to educate around this virus, you know, and tell you about the ways of transmission, and there weren't very many people disclosing their status, you know. But there was just, you know, there was some education going on when I went to this therapeutic community. And I attended whatever I could attend to learn. And I guess the denial started to melt away around this. And I got strong enough to be able to say, well, you know, I mean, regardless of what the motivating factors were, and there were several motivating factors, you know, the fear of going back and living as a productive member of society, and the fear of success and the fear of failure, and the wanting to die because there was so much fear, and wanting the guarantee that I was going to be able to stay clean and not go back to that lifestyle. There was a lot of factors, but nonetheless, I was also able to draw strength from these factors to go and take the test, you know. And I don't know, that kind of like worked for me, you know. But I know that very early on, firstly, I didn't think that this, first I knew absolutely nothing about AIDS. I heard it and I didn't even care to know what it was. And then when I did know what it was, it wasn't going to happen to me, so long as if I didn't get close to you, it wasn't going to jump off you and jump on me, so I just needed to stay away from you. That if I cleaned my works with water, I was okay. It wasn't about cleaning my works with bleach. And any way you put it, that was unrealistic for me, because I was not going to carry a bottle of bleach in my pocket. And you know what? When I was sick, if I needed works off the gutter, that's where I was going to get them. So all those other things were like not very important. So I was able to get to a place where I was clean and I was sober enough to come to a place and say, you know what, at least you're Zazy too, you know. Was one of the other things that I thought about when I finally decided to test. If I do test positive, there's AZT. AZT to me meant the cure, okay? That's a whole nother story, you know? There's AZT and I'll be okay. I didn't look at it as a way, you know, one of the ways of being able to slow down the progression of this virus, and that AZT doesn't work for everybody. I mean, I didn't have that type of information. But I knew there was AZT and I would be okay if I had this virus. So it was like, again, it's a struggle. You know, this stuff is a struggle from the very beginning.
You were asymptomatic, right? You always...
Yeah.
Yeah, you've never had any...
No, nothing.
What, I mean, but you've been having regular blood work.
Yeah.
So you have been, in some sense, tracking...
Yeah, I've always tracked it.
Yeah.
Even when I had my relapses, I did track it. One thing I never stopped was was to show up to the doctor. One thing I have never stopped is that if I get a cold, I immediately go to the doctor. I'm real clear that I have an immune deficiency. And that if something happens, I immediately have to go and get help to fight off whatever is happening. Otherwise, it's going to get real big. That's kind of like, that's my belief system, you know, with this virus, is that if I feel that I have a discharge, I call my doctor and I make an appointment to see her. I won't wait for my appointment. I will call and see her, and I'll deal with it immediately. I no longer wait for something to go away. Whether I was actively using or in the midst of a relapse and the grips of my disease of addiction, whenever something comes up, I'm real clear that I have an immune deficiency and that where my body's at, I can't fight things off like a person who doesn't have this immune deficiency can. That's how I deal with it. That's how I've been dealing with it, you know.
What has happened with your T-cell count?
My T-cell count has been stable throughout these almost 5 years. The only thing that has continued to decline in the last 2 years has been my platelet count. And I just went for a checkup this week, and the doctor told me, you know, that he wants me back in 2 months to do another set of blood work, because now he's into looking at what is this platelet decline about. I feel pretty okay. And I'm nervous about what it's about, because it has to do with my liver and my spleen. I have a history of hepatitis and chronic persistent hepatitis. So I have fear around it, you know. The doctor explained to me that I can have it treated. But all the options that he says and all the steps that would be necessary to take is nothing I'm going to have to make any decisions about today. For starters, I have to wait till November to have that second blood work done. There's nothing I could do to change my platelet count on my own. You know, what can I eat? What can I do to make this condition better? Well, there's nothing I can do to make this condition better right now. All I know is that it has been a steady decline for the last 2 years. It's half of what it was 2 years ago. Actually, a little less than a half. So that has me like a little nervous. It has not affected my T-cell count. It has not affected my percentage, T4s to T8s, it hasn't affected that. So there's no infection going on. But the spleen is enlarged, the liver is enlarged. This is a new doctor that I'm dealing with right now. My liver and my spleen has always been enlarged. So I'm just like, that's something that I need to put on the shelf, you know? Acknowledge that I have fear around it, but there's basically nothing I could do other than continue to sleep well and eat well and exercise and just continue to show up. But that kind of stuff provokes anxiety. Because throughout these years that I've been doing blood work, no one had ever wanted to look at something specifically because they're concerned. So now this man is concerned. And it's frustrating, you know, because it takes patience. There's nothing I could do, you know. What can I do better? What can I do that I'm not doing? Nothing.
What kinds of treatments have you been taking? I mean, what have you been doing in terms of... you mentioned, you know, the vitamins and supplements.
I do garlic, I do acidophilus, if I'm doing antibiotics, which is not really very much recommended. If you're HIV positive, doctors rather not give you antibiotics if they don't have to. But if I'm doing antibiotics, I do the acidophilus together with the antibiotics so that I don't wind up with a yeast infection. I do garlic. If I have a cold, I'll do garlic 3 times a day. If I'm okay, I do garlic just in the morning. When I cook with a lot of garlic. I do vitamin C 1,000 milligrams a day. If I'm dealing with a cold, I might do 1,500 milligrams a day. I've done acupuncture like that. I do massage therapy. And I eat basically at home. I don't eat out very much. I eat fruit. I take the skin off fruit because of the poisons that skin has, you know. I don't eat red meats. I eat a lot of fresh vegetables. I don't eat out of a can very much. I don't drink water out of the faucet too tough. In the last month or so, I'm not cooking with water from the faucet because of the lead stuff. So there's a lot of things that I've had to change. A whole slew of things that I've had to change over the years.
You mentioned earlier how one of the things that you were finding out when you had initially been diagnosed and you were part of various support groups and people were giving you information is that you were learning about insurance. Have you had any difficulty working with that, with healthcare?
No. But then I haven't been sick. You know, I know that if my status were to change at any time, right now I'm considering it, there's ADAP that I haven't had a need for it. You know, the vitamins that I do are over the counter and I pay for them. But I know that I would have access to ADAP. You know, right now I deal with Medicaid. Earlier on I hooked into 2 clinics. I had a private doctor and I hooked into 1 clinic, the Community Health Project. And they have pretty good doctors. And they have a women's clinic. And they're a satellite to Bellevue. So that if I don't have any money, or if I do have money, I could always go there for services. The staff there knows me. So I haven't come across, I'm on Medicaid now, which again, I use it like for dental work and for massage therapy and acupuncture and that kind of stuff. And I go to the same doctors all the time, you know. I stopped working and the private doctor that I was going to doesn't take Medicaid. He only takes the private insurance. So up until I was able to get on Medicaid, he's seen me several times and he didn't charge me. And it worked out pretty well. When I first started seeing him, that was one of the things I needed to do. I needed to interview a doctor and really be like, okay. And that was one of my questions. If I reached a point where I couldn't pay you, well, what would happen? And he told me that he would continue to see me. And that happened. For the first couple of months till I did get Medicaid. And there were 2 times, I believe, that I got sick. And I needed medication and I needed certain tests. And he took care of me, you know. So I don't know, one of the things for me, it's like it's real important to talk to your doctor. It's important to have a relationship and to be a partner in whatever is happening. You know, the doctor that I have at CHP, it's the same thing. He's my new doctor, but I can ask him, and he listens, and he answers, and he draws pictures for me, and it's important that you could have that kind of relationship with your doctor. And if in the beginning you don't have it, then maybe that's not the doctor you need. If you have a doctor that has an attitude that you know he knows best and he has the answers and you need not ask any questions, which again, that's something that I learned growing up. You go to the doctor and he knows best. You do what he tells you to do. And but I realized that with this virus, you don't play with it like that. You know, there were some doctors that want to put you on AZT like real early on. There were some doctors that give you pretty high doses of AZT. You know, there are some doctors that want to give you AZT and don't think it acyclovir with AZT is enhancing. And there are doctors that do. And what do you believe? You know, what do I believe? You know, let's forget what the doctor believes. What do I believe from the stuff that the seminars that I've been to and the forums that I've been to and the stuff that I've read? What have I taken from that stuff and incorporated in my life? What are my beliefs around this? If I don't have a doctor that respects my beliefs, that doctor isn't for me. So it's been like real important for me to have a relationship with whatever doctor I have. I've also been lucky that I have the same GYN specialist for the last 3.5 years, you know, and her specialty is HIV gynecological issues, and she's been great. And again, she's a woman that if I have something happening with me, I can call her at her office number, I can call her at the hospital. You know, my lover's gone with me, and my lover's talked with her. With Rietano, the same thing. I have to create my own safe place. And if it doesn't feel safe, I have to go with that gut feeling that it doesn't feel safe. And I have to look for something that is safe for me, you know. And that is gentle, and that is nurturing. Those are not things that I'm real familiar with, and those are skills that I've learned to apply with this virus, you know.
How much time would you say you spend each week dealing with AIDS?
A lot. A lot. A lot. This week alone, the HIV advisory committee is in the process of doing 5 forums in the boroughs, and facilitating the forums, which anywhere between 3 and 3.5 hours. Is what I did Tuesday evening. I work at the AIDS Service Center part-time. Monday 9 to 5, Tuesday 9 to 5, Wednesday half a day, and Thursday, you know, all day. That was on Tuesday. Monday it was a GMHD Board of Directors meeting, 2.5 hours. I spent a lot of hours doing this. I spend a lot of hours, at least 40 hours a week doing this kind of stuff. Then I come home, and when there's crisis close to home, then you deal with that also. You know, my son's father in the hospital last week, his wife also in the hospital for the last 3 months, in and out of the hospital, dealing with my son, because he looks to me for support, dealing with my lover, who goes through her stuff around this, asking me questions and all this kind of stuff, with my friends. I have a big network of, I'm surrounded, you're surrounded by this virus, whether you like it or not. You're surrounded and you have to deal. You know, you have to deal. You know, going out with people in my NA program, you know, that also live with this virus. My sponsor, you know, and her boyfriend has AIDS. He was in the hospital last week, you know. So I spend a lot of hours around this kind of stuff. Showing up for myself, you know. Tuesday mornings I do massage therapy. Sometimes once a month there's a nutrition clinic and I go to it once in a while. You know, Lesbian AIDS Project at GMHE that just started. I do a lot of phone stuff with them. So it's a lot that I do. People call me sometimes from rehabs because they have a client that's HIV positive and they need to talk. So they'll call me and we'll talk on the phone.
I have two big questions here. Sort of coming out of the stuff that you've been talking about so far. But also once again, kind of around the shift that occurred in your thinking when you decided to get tested and were dealing with all of the after effects of that. You mentioned how you then really started getting as much information as you could about transmission, about healthcare, you know, all kinds of stuff. And you also mentioned that you had a number of relapses with your drug use.
Mm-hmm.
How did your behavior change with your drug use and also sexually? What transference was there from the information you were learning to your actual personal?
I'll tell you one thing. When I've used drugs, it's real difficult to practice safer sex. Real difficult. Because you don't care. During a relapse that I had, I was in a relationship with a woman who was also positive. And it was... I dealt with it in this way. There's nothing happening with me. I don't have any discharge. I have no infections going on. I don't see anything that's wrong. And I don't think I have cuts in my fingers, so it's like, okay. And there was a lot of rationalizing and justifying to not use the dental dam, to not use the gloves, to not use the finger cuts. It's just so much easier to justify, you know. Plus, at that time, I was involved with a person who's also HIV positive. So during that period, during that relapse, the only time we practiced safer sex is if I knew I was around the week that I was going to get my period. If none of the above were happening, I wouldn't practice safer sex with this person. I mean, like, I don't have multiple sex partners, and I haven't since I know my status. And that's how I dealt with it at that time. And then I got back on track, and I wasn't willing to practice on safe sex. at all under any circumstances, because a risk is a risk is a risk. So it's like, if I'm clean and sober, it's very, very easy, or a lot easier for me to practice safer sex than it is when I'm using. When I'm using, everything is about justifying and rationalizing. In sobriety and in recovery, it's like, okay, I can't see anything, but what if there's vaginal warts happening on the inside? Okay? That kind of stuff you pass. You know, it's a virus that you pass on to someone else. What if I am in the beginning of a yeast infection that I can't see it today, but tomorrow morning I'm going to be able to see it? Well, those things are like real clear for me. When I was under the influence, I could justify all that. Well, if I was going to get a yeast infection tomorrow, I would probably have a bad odor today. And I don't know where I got all these justifications, but I was able to live with them. You know, it's real important that that I stay clean, because the act of using drugs is not a loving act. And the act of using drugs is not a responsible act. And although you may not want to hurt people, you hurt them. So recovery is like real, it's real important that I stay sober. Because I'm going to live longer, and because I know that my sexual practices definitely change. During a relapse, I'm not willing to share a set of works. You know, an active, before I knew my status, and if we were shooting dope, well, sure, you can use my works, and I would use yours. But after knowing my status, that was no longer okay. And that did not change. I mean, that was a stand that I took, that whether I was sober, that was just my stand, that I would not use your works, nor could you use mine. But on the sexual part, it's like, it was real easy for me to justify and play with that. And it just gets like real difficult. That just gets like real, real difficult, you know. Because in my mind, you know, and in doing education teaches you the different levels of risk. I think maybe that's why it's so easy for me to justify it, you know. Because when I talk about warts, and when I talk about yeast infections, I'm talking about cofactors. So I can get like real intellectual and real like okay-ish in my head around this stuff, you know. It's not like real okay-ish when you're talking about a needle, that you can't see what's inside of it, and that's always has some trapped blood. Needles have trapped blood because of all the little, but with sex, because I've learned, and it's still taught the same way, you know. Oral sex, because of the enzymes in the saliva, you know, and if you don't have bad gums, it's like okay, you know. That's kind of like the message that I kind of like get. Well, not that it's okay, the risk is real small. Versus having anal sex without a condom, if you're the recipient. So, you know, you could take some of this information and kill yourself with it. You know, in the frame of mind that I'm in right now, a risk is a risk is a risk is a risk. But once I put a drug in my body, well, it takes a whole different form. you know. And I guess it takes time, you know, for you. That's why I say it's a one day at a time process, and you incorporate pieces of this, you know. And there's some pieces that are incorporated and that I have totally accepted, and there are pieces that I haven't, you know. And yeah, my relapses clearly showed me pieces that I haven't. Pieces that I still do. I don't like that I have to use barriers. I don't like that I have to use barriers. I don't want to use barriers. You know, a lot of times my sexual practices are so that I don't have to use a barrier. A lot of times I won't deal with the oral sex. And just because I don't want to use a barrier. You know, let's play with the oils. You know, masturbate yourself, I'll masturbate myself. I've had to like cut some things out because sometimes I just like, there's sometimes that I'm okay, I'll use a barrier, what the fuck. But there's sometimes that, you know what, I just don't want to use the barrier. And I don't. I don't want to walk to the kitchen and get saran wrap. I don't want to do that. I don't want to go into the cars and get gloves. I don't want to do that. And I don't. But there's other things that I could do. You know. Because it's also taught me, it's taught me how to eroticize sex. It's taught me how to be creative. You know. I don't think I would have been playing with oils if I wasn't positive. I don't think it would have occurred to me. I wouldn't go to the seminars that I go. I wouldn't learn or attempt to learn how to have pleasure safely. I wouldn't have. I don't think I would have. I don't. But it's the things that I've had to do. You know, they're choices that I've made. Not had to, but they've been choices that I've made. You know, I've gotten uncomfortable enough to say, you know what, I have to do something about this and I don't know what to do about it and I have to find someone to teach me. And that's you know, it's a process, this thing. And that's the gift in testing early. That's the gift of testing early. That ultimately I'll be in a place where I'm okay with all these new facets that I've had to learn in 5 years, you know, whole new behaviors that I've had to learn, you know. And thank God I don't have to do like some people that I know have done. They've just had to shut their lives out to sex. And, you know, they shut their lives out to relationships. They shut their lives out to their families. Last week I worked with this guy. I do advocacy at AIDS Service Center. And this was a guy that was financially very comfortable and tested positive. Well, not tested positive, found out he had AIDS. Didn't tell anybody he had AIDS. He didn't tell his family. Didn't tell his friends. Dealt with it by himself. Got progressively worse, real quick. He has dementia now. He's at home. He lost everything. He's in the verge of getting thrown out of his house. This is a guy that November of 91, October of 91 was still working. Dementia was setting in, destroyed all his identification. I had to work with this guy from the very, very beginning. Totally isolated, family knew absolutely nothing. Family would have supported him. And I imagine that he had to shut himself out of everything. The doors just closed. He closed the doors. His world got real small. He lost everything. And nobody knew. Nobody knew. You know, I can't even talk to him because he has dementia and you can't have a conversation with him. But I've had to do all this paperwork in terms of, you know, going out to Jersey and getting him a new birth certificate and getting the Social Security card. And what we found was a passport. And all I had was that passport to work with. And, you know, hooking him into, you know, DAS and hooking him to SSI and SSD and not knowing his work history. You know, him not having insurance, you know, getting turn off notices for light and gas and telephone. And but I could imagine the misery that this man must have lived in with no one knowing. How alone he must have been, you know, and how isolated, and how he doesn't have a lover, he doesn't, so, you know, like, it's like I've had to, like create a picture of who this man, what maybe his last years or his last months have been like, you know, and I'm real grateful that that's not, like what my stuff is about, or, like, what I'm about, you know, with this virus. And that, yes, it has been a blessing to test when I did test. Because, but for the grace of God, there go I. You know. So,
all right, what I'm interested in, Addison, you have moved in so many different groups of people who are in so many ways, you know, particularly involved with AIDS, the prison population, the IV drug using population, the gay and lesbian population, minority populations. What impact have you seen this epidemic having on these communities in Brooklyn?
I have mixed feelings about it. Because of all the stuff that we just talked about, you know, there's a lot more education going on in the prison system than there ever was. There's very little being done for women, per se, in any of the boroughs. For one thing, the CDC definition has not changed as yet. I talked about some of the things that happen to women. There's no research being done on women. Very little research. There is no information compiled to be able to say what impact this is having on women. There's nothing to go back and say, well, you know, well, this happened at this time and, you know, this has been the progression or this has been the process and this has been the progress. That's not the case for women. This virus attacks women like real different. There's still the message that it's lesbian sex is safe sex. There's still that message. And it's disturbing because it's not. I personally know two women that were affected by women. Not that they think, they know. And again, because with these two women that I know, when it did happen, doctors didn't want to believe it. And it happened right here in Brooklyn. Both of these women are Brooklyn-based. I don't know. There are some communities that are untouchable. You know, the Asian community is an untouchable community. The Hasidic community.
Asian and the Hasidic communities are untouchable.
I don't know what's happening in those communities. This is a Hasidic community right here. I have two male friends that are positive. One is a rabbi, and his wife knows, and his children know. But nobody else knows. His parents don't know. He's been positive for 8 years. I don't know. It's scary. It's scary because that we're talking about a community that has a lot of sexual issues. If you cross the bridge, the Williamsburg Bridge at night, you see all the Hasidics buying sex. When I think about what's happening there, it's scary. It really is. Can we get into that community? The only ones that get into that community is Hasidics and educate. Are they doing it? I don't know. I don't think so. That's a difficult question. Because mostly what I see coming through the doors at where I'm at right now or the other places that I deal with are a lot of Latina women, women of color, a lot of the drug abusing community is coming in for services. And that's a big change. Because IV abusers were not coming in. And there is a couple of active people who come into our office regularly and are allowing us to do case management with them. And that was kind of like unheard of, all right, for a long time. Why that's happening is because there's a lot of new community-based organizations that are hiring people in recovery, are hiring people of color, are hiring people that community can identify with. It's real hard to go into an agency like a GMHC, to be a woman of color, to go to GMHC for services. That's hard stuff to do. But there's a lot of community-based organizations coming up now, and it's giving people permission to come out and allowing them to have a little bit of trust that these people care enough to want to take care of them and not have to deal with the fear of rejection, you know.
Are you seeing this happening in Brooklyn? I mean,
sure.
There are specific examples that you can refer to? the work that you do, for example,
I'm based in Manhattan. Yeah. The work that I do, I'm based in Manhattan. What we see happen a lot is people go to other boroughs to do their things. A lot of people don't want to do their things in their neighborhood because there's a lot of shame with this. You know, there's a stigma attached to being positive or having AIDS. You know, right now the situation that I told you with the family member, this guy really doesn't want his wife to die at home and come out in a body bag. He doesn't want the neighbors to see his wife come out in a body bag. Because people will know that she died of AIDS. It's a couple of blocks from here. That's how it is. Do these people want to go for services and support? No. Do they want to talk about it? No. Are they making efforts to get their kids involved so that their kids can get past the stuff with some facilitation? No. The shame is that deep-rooted and that ingrained. That's some of the stuff that I know happens in this area.
in order to try and compensate for this, have you ever... Would you consider that some of the work that you've done is activist work? You know, is this just attempt to try and aggressively raise consciousness to try and get things done?
Your question is this one of my reasons?
Is this one of the strategies that you've taken? One of the things that you've used in the way in which you've become involved in AIDS? Would you
definitely
call yourself an activist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
I mean, we know a lot of this happens in Manhattan, and that it's, you know, it's been incredibly visible and very vocal.
That's one of the reasons why that's one of the motivating factors for me, is that if I can do it, you can do it. And if I could do it and no one's hurting me, and I still live in the same place, you know, and I was on TV nationally, and I'm sure people in my neighborhood seen it, and I'm sure people in my building may have seen it. It's certainly aired enough times for people to catch glimpses of me doing this piece and other pieces that I've done. I haven't gotten thrown out of my house. I sign a lease every 2 years, you know. The guy in the vegetable store still sells me my fruits and my vegetables. I sit and talk with my neighbors outside. I have friends. I have people in my life who don't have this virus. That's my motivating factor for doing what I do and for being out the way that I am, is because I look at myself a lot, you know, you call it an activist, whatever, an advocate, a role model, you know. You create your own death sentence with this, you know. To let that shame eat at you, you create your own death sentence. I can't do that. I won't do that. I battle with my family. If it were up to them, I'd be in the closet somewhere, being ashamed and hiding. But I don't think that that's the answer. So I come out and I stay out, you know. And I feel like I am a power of example, you know, and that more of this has to happen so that what's happening right now with this man and his family doesn't continue to happen. So that people don't continue to behave in that way. So that people could live longer with this virus. Because all that kind of stuff creates stress, anxiety, death. It's not the virus that kills you. It's your attitude toward this virus that kills you. You know. Yeah, the virus plays its part, but there's a whole lot of other components that go along with this. You know, and they all have to be addressed. You know, and it's difficult to address them, and it's painful to address them. But I think in the end, you walk away with a full life. You know, whatever you choose for that to be for you, you know.
We know that a lot of, as you were saying, a lot of factors combine to make HIV the individual's decisions, the virus itself, and then a lot of factors combine to make treatment and care to actually respond and strengthen and make it possible for people to live. And a lot of those, as you've been talking about, are individual decisions and individual attitudes. And then some of those are the networks of support, the kinds of materials and resources that are made available to people. And it's very clear that you're very involved in trying to get these resources there and have them used in a way which is going to strengthen the people who need them. What do you think, once again, if we can sort of be specific with Brooklyn, do you think is needed in terms of those kinds of resources that, along with these sort of personal strength to want to actually live with HIV, need to be there in Brooklyn? What, for example, do you think the city should be doing? What should the federal government be doing? What should, you know, health agencies be doing? What should the state be doing to make sure that there are these kinds of resources available for people?
I think that some of the resources that are, let's say, located in Manhattan should be based in these areas. There should be more community-based organizations. There should be more technical assistance in Brooklyn. You know, this area over here, if I needed legal services around an HIV, there's nowhere near in this area, this vicinity. And you got a drug spot over on that side. You have a drug spot over on that, about eight blocks that way, and about six blocks up that way, and all along Coney Island Avenue. So I know there's a lot of HIV around here. You know, you walk six blocks from here and there's sex. You buy sex down the street. And there aren't any community-based organizations over here. You know, so where do these people go? I mean, I don't see people coming to do any street outreach over here. I don't see them setting up a table over here and giving out condoms and giving out literature and informing people. I see that in Manhattan. I see that in fairs when there's a Second Avenue fair. But in Brooklyn, there is very little of that stuff going on, you know, in areas that are devastated. You know, everything is based in Manhattan, damn near everything. You have the Brooklyn AIDS Task Force, downtown Brooklyn, where transportation is really, really difficult. It's really difficult to get over there. You have hospices, not in Brooklyn. You don't have any in Brooklyn. Hospices that are only for people that are homeless. The same situation that I just shared about this couple in Brooklyn. Where it would be real difficult for his kids to come home from school and see his mother, their mother, in a coma in the living room or in the bedroom with tubes running all over the place. There should be hospices for people who can't come home and die because of the situation at home. They're not homeless, but where they're at, there's no one really that can lift the burden off someone who just is in a place that has a lot of difficulty dealing with it. Where's this guy gonna go to? He's gonna either bring his wife home or turn his back on her. There's not that type of service in Brooklyn.
No. Before we started the interview, we were talking about the positive effects that AIDS has had on you. You know, you feel that there's a way in which you have been able to learn something about yourself through coming to terms with your HIV status. Have you seen, is there anything that you can think of positive that's come out of the AIDS crisis in terms of politics? In terms of these communities that you are a member of?
Yeah, good stuff has come out of it. This virus has definitely brought a lot of people together. You have the Living Well Commission. You know, there was a conference the end of August. Yeah, 300 people that were HIV positive come together upstate and meet and do workshops together. And there were people there that had never, ever shared their status with anybody. And people came from Brooklyn, from Manhattan, from Queens, people from upstate, Buffalo, New York, Albany. A whole range of people from different backgrounds there to share their experience, strength, and hope. Some disclosed for the first time. You were able to make a connection. You know, you met people that live real close to you and that are in your same situation. A lot of beautiful things happen. It's brought people together. It has definitely brought a lot of people together. It's brought families together. Yeah, we talk about the families that it's broken. It's brought families together. I don't know, it's definitely changed the quality of life. Not only for me, but for other people that I do know. The quality of family time. The values have changed. And, you know, for family members, you know, for people that are affected. I don't know, for me on a whole, it's just like it's brought people together. And that's about, you know, focusing on the positive side of this. It's brought people into recovery. It's brought a lot of people into recovery. A lot of people are healing. A lot of those old wounds as a result of this virus. Infected and affected. You know, this is, it's HIV AIDS is a tragedy, but it's been a hell of a change. I don't know, it's shed like a whole different light on life, and it's given it like a whole different meaning.
What are your hopes for your future, for yourself? What are you planning for yourself?
I plan to live a long life and continue to do this work. These are like my plans. My plans is to continue to have a growing relation, enriching relationship with my grandson and with my son. And just reaping the rewards of living. I mean, you show up for life and shit just happens, you know. You show up and stuff just happens. You know, it's not so much about making plans. I'd never been on vacations before when I was actively using, and I got my status, and I've traveled, and I've been to places I never thought I'd go to, and I've met real interesting people, and all I've had to do is show up, you know. All I've had to do is not pick up a drug, you know, and make myself available and share my experience, strength, and hope. And the rest happens. I mean, I'm like in a real spiritual place with a lot of stuff. It's not stuff that I make happen. I can't make anything happen. You know, all I could do, the only power that I have is to show up wherever I choose to show up, and be there for people. And have an extended hand, and that's what I get back.
Last question. People are going to be coming to this exhibition. Or let's just say, people are going to be hearing what you've said today. If there's one thing, one particular thing that you want them to hear, there's one particular message that you would like to communicate to people, what would that be?
The message, the concept of each one to each one. Um, and the message that you don't have to do this alone. This you don't have to do alone.
Thank you.